And just for my own news, today is the 6th of February, 2018. And this is Vic Schoenbeck being interviewed by Jared Fawcett and Sam Baxter. Maybe off of this.
And it's March 6th, 2018.
Oh, good. March 6th. Thank you.
Yep, already is.
And this is the interview with Bill Small that I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Southern Oral History collection, and I've got a place where I think I put the link to it for you all.
Oh, okay.
But I think we might want to think about having some kind of a online repository that has links to these things. I have this virtual library, mm-hmm. and we could use the virtual library, or maybe you want to have something on the MSC page that you're creating. But because there's now quite a bit of history resources online.
Right, exactly.
And finding them is sometimes a challenge.
Exactly. You usually always have to know the person to go to. You know what I mean? And even that person is usually hard to find. So that's one thing that we're trying to still be working with, thinking about the Gillings MSC page, to have a tab for archives where those can kind of be, first it's like playing catch up, and then you make sure you're also kind of keeping whatever was on that year archived so we can crunch down to hopefully over the next 5 years to have like a as comprehensive as possible
mm-hmm.
archives page, especially as we think about the upcoming 40th annual conference.
So in that vein, then we'll get to your topics.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
So each year the Minority Health Conference creates this very nice website.
Yeah.
And then when they put the next one up, they take down the previous one. And if they used a different system, so that the name, so that the year was in the website, then presumably they could just create a new one with the new year
mm-hmm.
and keep the old one, and then the old one would be online as a record.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been downloading the whole thing each year when I remember, though I didn't remember every year. But of course, doesn't work the same way because the links and all that sort
right.
of stuff are no longer working quite as well. So if they're worried to persuade the Minority Health Conference and the people who run the website for them to do it in a way that would let you keep building rather than always replacing.
And I think that's still a part of the growing process that we're doing with bringing MSC and MHC back together. I think mm-hmm. we made a lot of strides, especially this year. But as we kind of went to that online presence meeting, that was the first time I realized that I forget even, so basically someone in NCIPH manages that website altogether. But bad and good news is that person kind of like is no longer here, so that there may be an opportunity as we do think about this upcoming year to perhaps change some things with whoever this new person that's fulfilled that position.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking. I knew that we didn't have time mm-hmm. to talk about that at that particular time,
mm-hmm.
but I definitely agree. I like the Minority Health Conference page,
mm-hmm.
But I think it still could be more integrated and mm-hmm. more cohesive to show people, like, you know, especially co-chairs, especially, like, you know, what this looks like at the end, you know.
Well, maybe I should give you a little of the history of the webpage for the conference.
Sure.
So NCIPH, it wasn't called NCIPH then. It was
okay.
called the Office of Continuing Education, started putting up a website for the conference back in the 90s.
Right.
And I have copies of some of those. I don't have copies of the first ones because they had this procedure, which I guess they do with all their conferences, that when they put the new one up, they take down the old one. And at a certain point, I realized that that's what they did. So I copied their pages. It was pretty much one page onto the Minority Health Project website, which I was then managing.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, they said, well, why don't we not bother to create the page? If you're going to put it on the Minority Health Project website anyway, why don't you just do the website for the conference? So then I was doing the website for the conference on the Minority Health Project page. And when I did that, I would use the year as part of the link. You know, there'd be a cover page, Minority Health Conference. You'd click on the current conference and it would have 1998 or 1999, whatever. So maybe it was 2001 when I started. I can't remember exactly. So those pages are still there. And then I was doing the pages for the both the caucus, which didn't have too much, but it had the list of officers. I was doing the pages for the caucus and the conference up until sometime in the mid-2000, like 2004 or 5, and we could go back and look maybe a little later, I can't remember. And Felicia Mebbin became dean, associate dean, or assistant dean for students. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure for all of the reasons, but she arranged to get some funding for the caucus and the conference to have its own website. There was always a desire to have it on the school's website, but they actually created one in the Office of Student Affairs for the university. So the student organization's website, it was run on a platform called Joomla. And so she had some money, yeah. And they got somebody to create a Joomla site for the conference. And that went on for, and I tried to make a copy of that, and I think I did, to keep for the future, because again, they would replace with a new one. No, actually, the Joomla site, I think they maybe did use a year, so they had several versions. But then the student organization's website was dismantled. And so everything went. And so then I think this Office of Student Affairs got some money to create a version in WordPress. I'm a little vague on exactly what the sequence was. But I think that's when the web.unc.edu site was created.
Okay.
And I think that was originally done with some funding. And students were being trained to manage it. But the problem was that, you know, it takes a lot of time and you got to know how to do it. And so at the next year or the year after that, they were having trouble maintaining the site because they didn't have people to do it. And so then at a certain point, the NCIPH was asked to manage the site. And so that's how we got to where we were up until Becky Hart left last year.
Yeah. And I'm also just thinking about, well, one thing I'm glad about Gillings going to a WordPress application is it seemed like it's more sustainable, and there's an opportunity for students every year, essentially, like if there was an executive board member on MSC, they could be trained in how to do some things on the back end of WordPress, and the MSC advisor, the OSA staff, like they have access to that. So it's just a matter of students saying, this is what I'm going to change, this is where the changes have been made, please review, kind of, sort of. So I think I like that part about sustainability. But then also there's an opportunity for perhaps, I don't know if the webcast co-chair is it might be one of their responsibilities, but to kind of be more involved with the online presence that is still managed by NCIPH. But yeah, to kind of think through that a little bit better.
Well, it'd certainly be great if the students could do it. And it's much more than the webcast, because most of the site is actually things not related to the webcast.
Exactly. So I'm not sure if it fits with them, but I feel like giving their timeline, especially, I don't know.
Yeah. The webcast committee, you know, had real trouble this year. A lot of people who were on it left.
I know. I don't think that there has been a rigorous evaluation of why people go on the webcast versus not go on the webcast each year. And I think, you know, we've had some organic relationships that have formed with specific institutions. But at the end of the day, you know, these relationships are often based on the people who are there, what their advisors think and feel. And so as people do leave and phase out of institutions, you know, there's not really, which I understand it's not really a concerted effort to maintain the relationship, because they do happen often organically. And it is usually because someone has had a relationship with MSC or UNC, and that's why it kind of got started. Just think of a Brown University, like the former webcast co-chair. She kind of made a lot of strides this year to try to get Brown to be a partner conference, but they didn't get it. But, you know, she was confident, and she said actually after they watched the webcast this year, even though we didn't have the keynote do the thing, you know, they were really excited and they want to be a partner conference next year.
Wonderful.
They actually see the impact of the value added.
Wonderful.
You know, and so it's just thinking about, okay, I know how this relationship started, but how do we actually make this more of an institutional commitment? Which I don't think, again, I think it's about the motivation behind even signing up to be a partner conference. Is it the speaker? Is it the theme? You know, is it just because, you know, you believe in the value and the importance of the conference? You know, we really need to, I think, parse that out a little bit better. Especially as we think about getting other institutions to be a part.
Well, I think the key, you know, the key for the caucus and the conference was that they were student-led.
Definitely.
Student-driven. And I think the key with the partner conferences would be networking across the student organizations at the various universities.
Okay.
So that it was something that, I mean, it's really a movement. And it, within the school, it's a movement of the minority students working together to make life and their opportunities for education and to improve public health for minorities. And that really requires a national activity.
Mm-hmm.
So to connect with the students at UIC and Brown and Harvard and LA and Tulane and so on and work together, maybe even select the topic jointly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even select multiple people to be webcast so that there could be somebody being webcast from some other institution perhaps. So there would be a national minority health conference. Seems to me that that has the potential, A, for making it have more of an impact, and B, giving students networking opportunities that will serve them very well when they leave, because now they will have connections not only within UNC, but they'll have connections in these other universities. So when you go to, I mean, if you're an undergrad, when you go to graduate school, when you're a graduate student, if you go to get a faculty position or a research position of some sort, you'll have people there that you've already worked with, or at least you have set connections with.
Yeah, and I guess this is the health policy part coming out of me, but I'm always wondering about, like, who's sharing the cost and what, how much say do you get if you are not sharing the cost as much as someone else, right? As we think, I mean, it would be great to have a joint body, create a joint theme, but if I'm at Clemson University,
mm-hmm.
and I want to help create the theme, and I don't mind even participating in the webcast, but all I'm doing is paying the $100 for a partner conference free, I'm not sure how much my voice, I'm not sure if I should have a vote, actually. I mean, I don't mind voices getting ideas because I like diversity of thought and voices to come up with a theme, but I don't know if, because I'm only paying for a partner conference, that I should have a vote in what the theme is. Compared to, you know, if there are two institutions that have decided, you know what, we're going to bear the load of the part of the webcast. We're going to have a webcast here, and UNC's going to have a webcast there. So I'm not sure how that fits. And then I think, unfortunately, it also then goes back to, like, I think the bureaucratic nature of the institutions that we're a part of, you know. And Dean Reimer really being a strong supporter of the conference, you know, I would think that there might need to be some conversation among deans of, you know, what this means. I mean, things that get beyond the point, of course, but there are all these other factors now that may have to be considered as we think of a way to move forward, which is why I go back to kind of like the first part. It's like just really doing a better evaluation of the motivations to even attend to be a partner conference. I think if we understand that better, then I think we'll be able to really leverage to see how we can build this and how this can be, you know, equitable and inclusive. Because, you know, I have heard, not have heard, but in informal conversation with some student organizations that have, like, you know, been part of it, you know, they didn't say that it doesn't feel inclusive, but I think that's the underlying.
Inclusive in what sense? You mean race, ethnicity? Or
No, as far as, you know, we like this. We aren't doing this at our institution. There's a need, and so this is why we participate, but it's kind of like, I don't want to say invited, but inclusive as in the sense of, yes, helping to think of the topic, yes, helping to think of the speaker, you know? And I get it, you know?
So here's a model, that I talked with some folks at APHA about a couple of years ago, that we would try to get foundation funding to pay for people from minority student organizations at multiple universities to meet together at APHA,
mm-hmm.
jointly plan this conference for, it would obviously not be for the next February, it would be for a year later in February, in terms of coming up with a theme that people like and a keynote or multiple speakers or whatever, you know, some fashion of it. And then each organization would develop its conference sharing with each other. So that mm-hmm. would be a way that, I mean, there are a lot of things that you raised, and I'm glad it's recorded because we can come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
I would be delighted to have a discussion about that.
Yeah.
Probably this isn't the time, but unless you want it to be, because it's fine.
Well, with others, I mean, it'd be great to, you know, have other voice and other people's take. This is just my take of what I think I've observed, but, you know, everyone comes from a different vantage point. But yeah, I'd be really interested to think of just to hear people's thoughts on that and their willingness to, like, share some of, you know, the thought and load for the webcast and the conference in general. But just to transition a little bit,
mm-hmm.
moving to the Minority Student Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you all had as much time to talk about that at your last meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could kind of talk about what, how did you get involved as a student? And then how did you kind of, once you came back to UNC, get integrated once again into, like, the caucus and conference? Because, like, when I came to UNC, I think on admitted students day, I think I probably met you, and I didn't even, I mean, I knew about the conference, but I just saw you as, like, someone who was really integral with the caucus, because I think you might have been the advisor at the time.
Year was that?
This was...
What year did you
2015? I'm not sure.
I was an advisor for the caucus.
Yeah, I don't think I came in 14. So yeah, in 15,
I was an advisor for the
caucus. You was advisor of the caucus.
I mean, I'm an advisor of the caucus until you've told me not to be anymore, because
yeah.
I was officially asked to be.
Yeah.
I've never been told, okay, thanks. So I'm not sure if I'm an advisor now or not.
And so that's kind of like what my introduction to you was with. So kind of, you know, and now understanding more about Gillings, you know, how did you decide to come back and be involved again? When you are a professor, you have all these other responsibilities and obligations, then kind of what has kept you?
I wasn't involved as a student.
Okay.
I was a student first in 1972.
Okay.
In health education. And a caucus was existing then.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think of myself as, I mean, I wasn't the minority. I didn't mm-hmm. think of myself as, I mean, I was certainly becoming educated about minority issues, and I was generally supportive, but I was not an activist, at least not about minority issues particularly. Mm-hmm. I'd come off the anti-Vietnam War activism. That was no longer so much of an issue, but I had become really interested in the sexual revolution, so I was active in that respect. But I didn't, I mean, I guess I had some friends who were involved in the caucus. I certainly did. Because I was in health education, which at the time had, I want to say 50%, that may be an overstatement, but it was a large number of African-American students, a large number. So if it wasn't 50%, it was close to it. And several of them were involved in the caucus, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I finished health education, I was away from the school for a while. And then I came back in 77 in epidemiology. And again, I wasn't involved in the caucus. That was the year the conference started in March of 77, I think was the first conference. And I wasn't here then because I didn't start until August of 77. I don't think I went to the 78 conference. Not sure. I don't think I went to the 79 conference. I mean, I was just a student, and
mm-hmm.
and most people didn't go.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the mid-80s I went to a conference, at least one, and I'm not sure why it was. It may be because the keynote speaker, well, I don't know what led me to go to the first one. Might have been because I got involved in a research study with North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. Do you know them? They're the largest black-managed mm-hmm. life insurance company in the country. I was involved in smoking cessation research
okay.
and had applied to do a smoking cessation study in collaboration with North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. And so I was beginning to think about minority health now, and I was beginning to learn about minority health. And I think the first conference I went to may have been 1987, possibly. I'm blocking on the name of that. It was the health director from Fayetteville, the county that Fayetteville's in, who was the keynote, Jesse, blocking on his last name. But anyway, he gave a terrific talk, I have to say. It was in the auditorium in Rosenau Hall. But on this, the next thing that happened was that there was an RFA from the National Cancer Institute for cancer control research, for minority cancer control research, it was called. It was for cancer center supplements from minority cancer control research. And since I had this other grant, the chair of my department, Barbara Hulka, really urged me to put in this, to work with the cancer center to apply for this funding. And we did apply for it, and we got the grant. And in the application, I said we would work with the Minority Health Conference, because I thought that was a strength. You know, the school's got this conference and the caucus, so we would work with the caucus to use the Minority Health Conference to talk about cancer control and things like that. Well, it turned out that we did get the grant, but the conference didn't take place, because there were 2 years when the conference didn't take place, just because the caucus that year didn't have students who had the time or motivation or opportunity or whatever to work on the conference. So I went to Bill Small and I said, Bill, we got this grant now and we could put some money in. And he said, well, you know, we can get this conference going again. So he called together the minority students and talked with them, and they agreed they wanted to do the conference. And he went to the dean, and I think he got like $5,000 from the dean's office, which was probably more than the dean's office had been giving in previous years. I'm not positive, mm-hmm. but I think it was an increase. Also, my wife had worked for the Office of Continuing Education, so I knew about them. And I thought, you know, gee, one would want to have the Office of Continuing Education involved in a conference one's putting on. They're professionals. They've got lots of resources and know-how. And they hadn't been involved in putting on the conference before. It had been entirely student implemented. So I suggested to Bill that maybe the dean would offer the services of the Office of Continuing Education. And he did. And so when the 1991 conference was planned, it was with someone from the Office of Continuing Education, or two people, plus the students, who were certainly in the lead as always, and Bill Small was there as an advisor, and I was there as a potential supporter. And the conference was planned, and it came off very well, and it was at least as large as any they'd had. It filled up the Rosenau Auditorium, which was bigger then, probably about 270 or something seats. And I'm not sure if it was that year or the next year, but they had to get overflow rooms in Rosenau, mm-hmm. where they were using closed circuit video to share it and so on. And it was a huge parking problem, because of course you couldn't park here, so had to get people here in their cars and then get up from wherever they were parking was always a challenge. But so those conferences were very big, very successful. They were recorded, or parts of them were recorded rather, and the recordings I think disappeared. I've not heard anywhere where they could be. I'm not sure whether they were stored in Bill Small's office, which seemed likely, and maybe when he left things got disposed of, or maybe they were stored somewhere else, and when Rosenau was renovated things got pitched, you know, they were in the basement maybe, I don't know. But if they could be recovered, there were recordings of the keynotes from several of those lectures, from several of those conferences. So then it got too big, and then it went to the Friday Center as a place where there was parking and where there was more room for a larger conference. Mm-hmm. And then it started filling up the Friday Center.
And so how did your involvement with the conference transition to also being involved with the caucus?
Good question. I'm not really sure that I know the answer. I mean, they were more closely intertwined in the 90s.
Okay.
Is part of it. Now the conference planning committee is largely white students. Mm-hmm. Then it was almost entirely African-American students. Mm-hmm. And occasionally there'd be a Latino student or an American Indian student occasionally. But it was pretty much black for years. The white students didn't start coming into the planning committee until, maybe the late 90s or something like that. We might be able to guess from some of the names on the planning committee rosters. There were two Asian Indian students who were co-chairs and then chair in the late 90s. Rashmi Agarwal was the second, and Sohini Sengupta was the previous one. But before that, I think they've pretty much been African Americans, or occasionally a Latino or Latina. The caucus at some point decided they wanted to be something other than the conference. And so the caucus, I think, kind of pulled away from the conference a bit. And maybe they were troubled that the conference was occupying all the energy and they wanted to see other things happening. We'd have to go back and look at, you know, I've got some records that I could look at to see. The caucus started a project to, they had something called REACH for bringing undergraduate students.
Yeah, REACH.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a previous existence before that, and I forget what the name was, but I might be able to find out, which was done in conjunction with the school. And I didn't, you know, I was involved with the caucus to some extent, but not that much until, I guess maybe after Bill Small left. You know, Bill Small retired in 99. And maybe I started getting involved in, you know, going to meetings and things like that a little bit after that. And I guess I was pretty much involved in encouraging and supporting. And, you know, partly I got this idea that there weren't enough minority students or minority faculty in the school and in public health. And there weren't going to be for a while because, you know, there's all this talk about diversity, but it's a lot more than diversity and inclusion that we need. We also need resources, mm-hmm. and so on. And you know, this morning there's been a program on the 1A, that program, mm-hmm. .1A.org, about the Kerner Commission report from 50 years ago and the progress that's been made since then. And the progress is, as it was described by one of the people on the program, in absolute terms, there's been substantial improvement. In relative terms, there's been next to no improvement. So the situation in the diversity is, yeah, there's some more people, but the whole place is bigger. And so the percentages really have changed very little. So I got the idea that one thing you do in that situation is you give more resources and leverage to the fewer people that you have. So like in a survey, when you have a survey and you want to get more information about a population, there's a non-response or attrition or something like that. So when you do the analysis, you increase the weight for those people. So if there's higher attrition among blacks, then you put higher survey weights on the blacks. So when you get your averages later on, there's an appropriate representation. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, what we should do is, if there are only a few black faculty and a small number of black students, or Asian or Latin America or Latino or American Indian, give them more resources, give them more leverage, so that they're having more influence. So I was working with I got that thought, that line of thinking in the mid-90s, I guess it was. So I was working with the caucus to try to be helpful in that sense. And then Felicia Mebben became the assistant dean for student affairs. And she was troubled at my role with the caucus. And I think she thought the students ought to be doing it without I shouldn't have as much of a role. And she pretty much said that to me as much. And I was very troubled by that because I had assumed I was being helpful and that it was welcome. She also clashed with some other people, and Bobby Banks was the co-president then. And Bobby essentially arranged for me to, she asked me to be an official advisor for the caucus. So when that happened and I said yes, then that made it clear to Felicia that mm-hmm. no, Vic was welcome and what he was doing was welcome. So then I became even a bit more involved, I guess, certainly no less involved. And that went on until, it would go up and down depending upon what the caucus wanted to do and how much involvement they wanted from me. But I was never directing the caucus in any way. It was mm-hmm. it was always led by the co-presidents. And some years the co-presidents would be very active. I mean, Bobby Banks was incredible what she did during her tenure. I guess that was with, who was with her? Was it Janelle Armstrong? I'm not remembering.
It might have been.
I know Janelle was a co-chair of the conference back around then. I can't remember. But then the co-presidents after Bobby, I think, were not as active for a while, and then other co-presidents came in and they did more. And it's hard. Students are expected to do so much more now than when I was a student. We had traineeships, a lot of us, and so you didn't have to work. Now people are all working, and they're expected to do more in terms of publication, and they're expected to do practica and, you know, all this stuff. So it's impressive to me that they can do as much as they do with things like the caucus. I mean, you, for example, I assume you put your degree on hold for a while you do this. It's not necessarily a bad choice if you can take the time.
If you could briefly talk about Echo, mm-hmm. and kind of how it started and kind of how it has ended.
Yeah, Echo's been an interesting situation, and I think I talked a little bit about this last time, didn't mm-hmm. I? There was, so let me go through the beginning of it fairly quickly. There was a movement to create a minority health research and education center in the School of Public Health. Mm-hmm. This was in the early 90s, and it followed on, or it grew up during a strategic planning process that Michelle Ibrahim instituted. And Dot Brown was an important part of that, and several other people, but Dot's the person who stands out in my mind, and I had some involvement. And Dot Brown had a project called Project RAP, and I had this Minority Cancer Control Research Program. And Dot and Lloyd Edwards and Trudy Bennett worked together to get a minority health project funded through the NCHS. So there were these three projects at the time. And Dot's vision was, and a number of us were thinking, that okay, so now a center could be created, or a program or whatever, because the center is official and needs official approvals, could be created, and these three things could be part of it, and then it would already be a going concern, and that would give the school an opportunity to expand and accelerate the degree of minority health research. And there was support from the dean's office for this. There was a B budget request, which used to be the mechanism that the university could get additional money from the state, but the B budgets disappeared that year. There was a request for space in the Sonia Haynes Stone Center, which was being built then, but that didn't get whatever. Michelle Ibrahim put some money into pilot grants for minority health research, and there was an attempt to, it was even, at one point Dot told me that the dean had named her as the director, but that got backpedaled later, and I never did find out what the total story was. But it didn't seem to go beyond that mm-hmm. for a number of years. And then Bill Roper came in as dean, and he called us together and said, so what do we want to do about this? And we, it may have even been my suggestion. You know, it was a number of years since we talked about this. Maybe it'd be good to get some people from outside to come in and say, would this really serve a need? And by the way, if they looked like people we might want to have as the director, maybe we could identify a director that way. So Bill Roper arranged for a series of people to come in, leading people. I'm blocking on some names. Srika Kumanyika is one person I do remember well. I can get the names. There was a man from San Francisco State, blocking on the university, but he's now at Duke now. He's the head of the medical school, I think, at Duke, or health affairs or something. He was one who came. The man who passed away, sadly, who was the first head of the minority health in the public health service. It's terrible to lose names like this, but we can retrieve them. But not him, unfortunately. And a year or two later, when it didn't actually go anywhere, we had a gathering with Bill Roper, and I said, so what happened with the Minority Health Resource Center? And he said, well, we actually were negotiating with this man, and he died on the golf course. Mm-hmm. And that there was one more person who came through, and that didn't seem like the person. So then what happened was that there was an RFA from, what's that part of the federal government? Health care. HFCA, it's the one that has the peak personnel. It's the one that Bill Roper was in before he came to UNC years ago. Sorry, I didn't prepare more for this. But anyway, we could look that up too, and we can edit in it if necessary. But anyway, they came out with an RFA for minority health kinds of things. And so Bill Roper thought, here's an opportunity, we can get some money. But it looked like it needed to be something bigger than just the school, partly because we didn't really have many African American or other minority faculty here, certainly not senior ones. So he asked Tim Carey, in the School of Medicine to work with Paul Godley in the School of Medicine
okay.
to write up something. And they put something in that had, I think it was four research projects plus some overarching things, and I had a role in there for some dissemination kinds of things. And they were going to be four funded through this mechanism. And when it came down to it, I think UNC's proposal ranked fifth or sixth. But the administration and the federal unit decided what they would do would be to fund eight, but they would fund the last four at a low level. So they, so the budget had to be greatly slashed, and a lot of things got cut out. But there was enough for something. And they created the Center for Excellence on Overcoming Racial Health Disparities, I think is what it was called. And the PI was Tim, and Paul Godley was prominent. And I think it may have been headquartered at the Shep Center. But when that happened, then Bill Roper and the Dean of the School of Medicine used that as an opportunity to create something that would be university, that was not part of that same thing. And he had connections at GlaxoSmithKline that he thought would put in $300,000, and that would be the seed money for this project. So that's where ECHO came from. And there was a steering committee with people, prominent people from all over the university. They all gathered together at the Alumni Center, I think. And there was a discussion of, what should we call this thing? And I think Paul Godley came up with the ECHO name. So that was ECHO, and there were discussions about, so what should this do? And the emphasis at the time was on community-based research. The community should be guiding what goes on, and UNC, that ECHO should create, they should have two offices in the state, one in, I think, Rocky Mount, and the other was maybe in Winston-Salem, where there would be a research support person, and faculty could then interact with community organizations. These people in those places would go out and form relationships with community organizations and community leaders in those places. And so when I, as a researcher in the School of Public Health, wanted to do a project that was going to involve the communities, I wouldn't have to start from scratch. I could go to the ECHO person and say, so I want to do a project in this area, what do these people need? How can we design it so that they can, can they be the community advisors? And it was going to be a way of increasing the level of community-based research. The problem was that it's hard to get stuff like that started. There weren't all these investigators at UNC jumping to create projects like that. So these projects never got formed.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that Paul Godley and Anissa Vines put together on prostate cancer. And maybe,
around what time was that?
This would have been in we'd have to look it up, but it would have been the early years of ECHO.
Okay.
So that was probably around 2005, I'm guessing,
okay.
or 2003. And I went to Paul and said, so Paul, the Minority Health Project, which I inherited in 1998, and was running, Dot Brown came, who had been preoccupied with a research project of hers. That ended, and so Dot Brown took control of the Minority Health Project in like 99 or 2000, and I gave it, I said, here, it's yours, you should have it. So she did that, was leading it, and I was working with her. And before then, it had been housed in the biostatistics department, because when Lloyd Edwards was running it, it was housed in biostatistics. And when I inherited it, Epi had no space, Epi wasn't really interested, and the dean's office wanted it to continue, so they persuaded BIOS to hold on to it. But when Dot Brown took it over, she wanted to move it to MCH, and of course BIOS was happy to have it moved out of their space, so it moved to the MCH department. But then Dot went to Morgan State University, I guess it was, on a one-year leave, if I'm remembering correctly. And the dean's office persuaded MCH to hold on to the office space, let us keep the office there because we had some staff for at least a year. And so it was there, and then Dot Brown decided to stay at Morgan State, and so the project left MCH, and by then it didn't really have any staff, and so we really didn't need space. And so then it was back in Epi. Well, it was funny because it was in it was not in any other place, but Epi didn't want to manage it for the business affairs, so MCH kept doing that for a while longer, and then at some point the dean's office was trying to do that for us, so that didn't work out great either. And finally, Epi took it on when the new business person came in. But where was that coming? That was coming because you asked me about... Oh, Echo. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm now. Basically, Echo...
Let me go back. I got my train of thought back. So when Dot left, and so MCH was letting go of this thing, the question was, well, where should it go? And I talked to Bill Roper. I mean, I emailed him, and he said, well, it should go in Echo. Because, you know, Echo was going to be this... Echo was going to be the nucleus or the seed or the sapling or whatever of this mm-hmm. minority health research program that the school had been hoping to create for a decade. So I went to Paul Godley and I said, so would you, can we bring this into Echo now? And, you know, that's great. We'll have this bigger thing and we can be your broadcasting network. And he wasn't really interested. I said, you don't have to take the financial obligation. You know, you don't want to have any responsibilities. You would obviously support it in a general sense and so on. But he didn't want it. I've never understood why. He said, well, we could take your website. You know, we could take the Minority Health Project website if you want. And that was the... I said, no, I can't give that up. Mm-hmm. How can I have this, you know, conference and whatnot without the website? So I've never understood that. He did hire staff that at first they didn't have any particular needs, you know, person things for the person to do. So for 1 year, he lent me this person who was probably a half time, or he lent me half of her time to work on the video conference, which he did. And then the following year, we paid for, I think, part of her time, and she worked on the project, on the thing. But that didn't work out for some reason, which I never fully understood either. She got really unhappy with the thing, and I don't know what it was that I did, if I did something or what. But anyway, so we had a cordial relationship with Echo, and some years they would promote us more than others, and some years they would be involved more than others. But it was always a parallel activity.
Okay.
And I never fully understood why they didn't want it. We had conversations subsequently about merging the two together, but it never seemed to really happen. So Echo, they would have a seminar series. Mm-hmm. They would...
the weekly bulletin.
They had a weekly bulletin. They tried to get some research going, but I think the only projects that they really got were the ones that Paul and Anissa did mm-hmm. On prostate cancer.
And then through Echo, there's also the interdisciplinary certificate on health disparities as well.
Right, that began for later on
in the
process. And I wasn't involved with that. I mean, I was a supporter. I was happy to see it, and I encouraged people to do it. But I was never a part of that. I may have given a talk in it one time mm-hmm. or something, but I think that was a really good thing, and Echo was connected to that very much. So Echo did a number of things. It had a good website, and we collaborated on some things. I mean, they endorsed the conference from time to time, mm-hmm. and sometimes, I guess, we got some money from them. I can't remember. But, it was largely separate.
No, yeah, I understood. So I was just getting your perspective on, kind of how it started, and then kind of then, how did, because, Echo's no longer...
Well, so Echo, there were several issues with Echo. One was it was medical school and public health, and in principle, other schools. Mm-hmm. It was not public health, and the original offices weren't even in the School of Public Health. I think they had space in the School of Nursing originally. So it was the people who wanted a School of Public Health minority health activity weren't quite getting that. And there were no faculty really here to really be involved with it mm-hmm. until Diane Rowley and Vijaya Hogan came. And then they did the certificate. They didn't do so much with Echo.
Gotcha. Okay.
Then the School of Medicine, the translational research mm-hmm. became
Tracks.
Big, mm-hmm. and NC Tracks. So that was a huge, that's like the 1,000-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
So they came in to do this. And that displaced, community-based research, why bother with Echo? You got Tracks. Yeah. And so Echo became kind of secondary to Tracks. And what do you need Echo for? So they had this model. The model never quite worked.
Gotcha.
Because they couldn't quite get these projects going. And then a much bigger player came in that was going to be promoting that. And so I think it was really unable to build a source of revenue. It was decided early on that they wouldn't keep money from grants that they got. I mean, that if they, because it wasn't, they weren't, people didn't want them to compete with other programs like overhead.
No, yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. I think from the student perspective, I was mostly concerned that when Echo kind of was discontinued, because they had some great information in their weekly bulletins, but then also it was, I know several students who started, you know, the interdisciplinary certificate on health disparities. And now that, in looking at it, it makes sense, like the names that you brought up who kind of like helped create it, you know, Vijaya Hogan and Diane Rowley, and then like, you know, when they're no longer here, what does that mean for the disparities courses?
See,
and
I don't think
faculty leave, disparities courses seem to leave.
I don't think Echo was necessary for the certificate. It was the faculty who were necessary.
No, exactly. But once faculty have left, you know, Echo was still like the body that I think kind of helped facilitate that process.
It did.
And so that by facilitating, that doesn't mean that they were like, you know, designing courses or any of that.
Well, they were supporting Anissa to some point, and
no,
she
exactly.
was one of the faculty who was part of that certificate.
Yeah.
I don't want to downplay the role of
No, I'm not. I don't mean to downplay the role of it either, but it just, I feel like as a student, Echo had was very relevant and salient. But it's interesting, it's helpful to understand like how the parallel in which it grew, and then all of just the other competing factors at the university. I think it was a major loss from the student's perspective because of those two major aspects.
Well, I think the loss of Echo, the certificate, and the faculty is a major loss from the student perspective. Now, the faculty, they were both hired as research track faculty, which means, maybe, I guess they weren't officially research track, maybe they were clinical or public, or the practice, whatever. Mm-hmm. They weren't tenure track.
Right.
And though even in the tenure track now, faculty are expected to bring in a whole lot of their money. So if you're bringing in your money and you're getting what you need to do done, you can have a very good career and an enjoyable career. It's maybe a little busy, but the problems come when you're not bringing in the money, or you're having to do things to get the money that are taking you away from the kind of things that you want to do and that the students want you to do. So the problem, I think, is that Diane and Vijaya, when they brought in money, it was for things that took them away. So Vijaya's research was often outside of Chapel Hill, and she was traveling here and there, mm-hmm. and so on, though I don't know much in detail about it. And Diane, I think, wasn't bringing in that much money. And so then the chairs make the faculty feel uncomfortable. And teaching the courses, yeah, you're supposed to teach courses, but you know that's not enough for your salary.
Right.
So I think the problem was that their lives weren't really working for them here. And so then they weren't excited to stay.
And so thank you. And so the final question, I guess, which seems to be a good kind of stopping point, is, and it's I feel like it's two parts, but just whatever you take from it, it'd be great if you could answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's written as, you know, what advice would you give to students or faculty? Well, let's say faculty. What advice would you give to faculty who acknowledge, you know, their health equity issues or needs in Gillings, in the world, in research, but are not yet activated or who don't feel equipped at the moment to kind of deal with these things, whether it be in the classroom conversations, or in, you know, research?
What advice would I presume to give to faculty who want to do something but don't feel equipped?
I think I think that at this particular stage in Gillings, especially in student leadership, kind of hearing some of the students' concerns and hearing some of the faculty's responses to student concerns, it's not for a lack of acknowledgement or a lack of valuing matters of equity or disparities, but it kind of seems that, you know, they don't have the tools, they are not equipped, or, you know, they don't know how to handle this particular subject in the classroom setting, you know? And I was just wondering what your advice
is. Well, you know, there's an infinite amount of information out now. Back in the 80s, in the 70s, in the 80s, you could say, well, we don't really have the data. We don't really have the knowledge about what's going on and stuff. Now, partly with the web and partly with the research that's gone on and the news reporting and whatnot, there's an infinite amount of information, although it's somewhat conflicting, and life is complex, so that's the way it's going to be. But, you know, we are all operating in contexts, and the contexts are that the university, I mean, is funded by people who wanted to do certain things, and they want faculty to do certain things, and management of faculty is becoming more so rather than less so. So back in earlier years, faculty had a lot more latitude, I think, to do what they wanted to do. But as the financial demands have gone up, and the, we didn't used to have post-tenure review, now we have post-tenure review. Promotions used to be more available, now promotion is a bigger deal. Getting a grant is now expected and more challenging. The number of publications one's expected to have is higher. You know, you see this as students. I mean, if you're a PhD student, you're supposed to be publishing even before you get your PhD. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the case when I was a PhD student. And not only that, you're expected to have a publication besides your dissertation on some of the, that wasn't an expectation then. So the expectations keep ratcheting up. And faculty, you're trying to survive. You know, they're trying to thrive and survive. If they were prioritized, you need to do things on diversity and health equity. This is how we're going to evaluate you. Then more people would do that. But unless it's that case, they may have the most wonderful feelings in the world. Mm-hmm. But you don't get to do what you want, except within the constraints of, here are the three things you can do that will get you promoted. And promotion is also, if it's a tenure track, if you don't get promoted, you don't get tenure, and then you're out. So it's not just, I want to get 10% more salary than I'm getting now, but your raises are connected to that and everything. So there's an attempt to manage everybody, and the management attempt comes from the legislature, comes from UNC General Administration, comes from the chancellor's office, comes from the dean's office, comes from the chairs, comes from the PIs of who's ever bringing in the funding. And as long as that's the way it is, then there need to be countervailing forces. Now, the students can be a countervailing force. You know, when this caucus was formed, they were formed because students were unhappy about what was going on. So when there were no black students here, they may have been unhappy, but who here knew about it? Mm-hmm. People here did. I mean, people were concerned. They were doing things. There was a joint program with NC Central, so right. I'm not trying to dismiss that. Then there were a few black students, and they were trying to struggle and survive. But when there were more black students, then they began to say, hey, we're not getting what we want, what we need, and they formed a caucus and started to agitate and so on. Well, that changes the calculus for the people in the administration. In those years, it was easier to change the calculus. They were really open to it. They had some latitude. But then, over time, things get tighter.
Yeah.
And they're countervailing forces. The legislature, somebody or other was saying, hey, look how much money they're spending on diversity in the UNC system. Maybe we shouldn't be spending it. What are we getting for this money? So, you could try to do, what if we want to have faculty who are teaching about health equity and they're getting paid to do that? Other people will say, well, why should these faculty get paid to do, the other faculty aren't getting paid to teach, they're getting made to go out and get research, why this? So I think there needs to be a change of consciousness more broadly. And I think that one of the keys is, why are white people still unhappy? Because it's the unhappiness of white people that leads them to be ungenerous, basically. I mean, the wealth gap, the relative income, and the various other measures between blacks and whites are not substantially better. In fact, they seem to be not better at all in many ways than they were 50 years ago, despite great absolute improvement for a lot of us, not all, but great absolute for many. But the relative is not better. We know that the reason that the relative wealth and salaries are so starkly different was slavery and racism and Jim Crow and the federal programs that were racist in their application, like the Federal Home Administration and, you know, all these things. So we know the reasons for these gaps. They're not going to go away. Why would they just go away by themselves? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it about black people that they should be able to progress faster than white people? Presumably they wouldn't progress faster. Well, if they're not going to progress faster, then as black people progress, white people progress. So the relative differences stay there. And yet, why is it that white people aren't willing to say, yeah, you know, we really did have an unfair advantage. And yeah, it wasn't I, but it was people who were my ancestors or their ancestors or whatever it is. I mean, whether you're personally related to it or not. And you can say, well, I'm an immigrant, so what did I have to do with it? This is the way it was. I just came into it. Yes, but of course you were able to come into it and you got opportunities when you came into it. So we should, why wouldn't we have an estate tax, for example? So we've taken away the estate tax. There used to be an estate tax. You know, you're leaving a lot of money behind. Leave half of it to the federal government. Used to be more than half, but leave half of it to the federal government. Now we don't want an estate tax. Progressive income tax. We don't want that. Mm-hmm. Cut my taxes. Where's the generosity? Where is charity? Yes, there is philanthropy.
Yeah.
But it's not philanthropy in sense of only the billionaires club, you know, I'm going to give away half of my wealth, but it's not necessarily redistributive. So until we can get white people to feel generous or pushed, because the other aspect is if you have a strong enough political movement that can push them. But that's, you know, you're talking revolution, really, mm-hmm. because you get a strong push and then you get a push back and you get a push, and that's kind of natural how it works. The other thing, which you may or may not be popular, is intermarriage. Mm-hmm. I think that racial intermarriage is one of the most fundamental ways to eliminate the black-white health disparities and wealth disparities. And historically, that's what's happened in communities. People intermarry, then, oh, well, you know, they're in my family, and I think that could help a lot. And the barrier against intermarriage is now weakening. It was mm-hmm. very strong for centuries.
Yeah.
So my advice, intermarry. I think transcendental meditation has great potential. Because TM seems to dissipate anger, seems to help make people more appreciative, and open their awareness to broader implications of things. We lose a great deal from having this binary society or this highly stratified society. Why in the world would a society want so many of its children to grow up in poverty without the basics to have a fruitful life? Or, you know, why be held back? What do I gain by getting some more money than this other person if the result is that this other person is not going to be as able to contribute, as useful to me if I need help? So, you know, I'm getting old. I'm going to need people to care for me at some point. I care that I have Social Security to do that with, you know, that I have money. But whom am I going to employ? Are the people I'm going to employ going to be healthy enough to take care of me? Are they going to be well-spoken? Are they going to be gentle? Are they going to be loving? Are they going to be all these things? Well, if you bring people, if people grow up in poor, violent neighborhoods, for example, those aren't going to help them develop. Their epigenetics won't be such that they will be really suited to provide the kind of care that those of us with money are going to want in our old age. Mm-hmm. So, and for what? What do we get with this huge amount of money that some people feel the need to have? So I can go to Italy or Hawaii, whatever, for a weekend when I feel like it? Well, you know, it's short-sighted, narrow thinking, being distracted by emotional things. There was a program on the State of Things today at noon, I'm going to listen to it tonight, about neurological factors that influence what people believe. So you get fake news out there. Fake news doesn't do anything if you don't believe it. What are the factors that lead some people to believe it mm-hmm. compared to others?
I think that's a good stopping point.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for letting me talk. Hope I didn't talk too much.
So,
you know, I was cut it off.
So one thing that we'll be in touch with you about is, you know, I think because this is your final year of your phase retirement, the Minority Student Caucus wanted to honor you in a way for your service through the decades. And so we were thinking about one day in April, perhaps, just to have like a social or something, just to have people come out, because we know that I think your department may be planning something, I hope.
I'm Chandra told me that she's supposed to be doing something.
Okay, so Chandra should be planning something. And you know, we were thinking like, oh, well, let's do a joint thing, but we're like, you know, no, because I mean, we can let your department do that. I mean, this never a bad time. You can never get too many thank yous, long story short. So we'll be circling back with you for some dates that will work for you, that you'll, you know, be on campus. It'll be during the daytime.
Okay, that's
so
fine.
That won't be
you know, I guess what would be most enjoyable to me would be something that was useful to the caucus.
Okay.
And something where we got some of our alumni back here, and, you know, like famous people, even local ones, when let them tell their stories, I think might be really interesting.
Okay.
And fun. I mean, that's just one thing. And I hope to see the conference do that next year, if we could.
Yeah, I'm really, I mean, as I've been listening to your discussions, and also just with the time here today, I'm really thinking that I don't know how I think we need to do we need to just have special care with selecting people for the co-chairs for this particular year. I don't think that this number 40 should be taken lightly. Yes, you know, you come up with a theme, but I feel like there should be some more involvement in actually curating the theme for this upcoming conference. You know, because, I mean, one thing that I would love to see personally is, like, an alumni session. But I wouldn't necessarily want that alumni session to compete with the other breakouts. I don't know if that means having one of the keynotes be actually an alumni panel. I don't know what that means, you know. But I hope that people, whoever the co-chairs...
Yeah, maybe that would be... I mean, have an alumni panel instead of the afternoon keynote.
I don't know what the co-chairs... Who the co-chairs will be yet, but just thinking that, you know, I hope that kind of thought is put into it. Because, I mean, this is a good time to look back as we continue to move forward.
Well, and we're going to lose our alumni. I mean, you know, the older alumni are getting pretty old.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We've already lost some of them.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, like, for example, like, you know, John Hatch was here, and, you know, it was just really interesting to, first of all, he was like, you know, he forgot kind of to register, and we, of course, made it happen for him. He didn't forget to register. You know how, like, we always get to capacity. We're to capacity, and then he tried. He's like, oh, they locked me out.
Oh, did he try to register?
He was like, they wouldn't let me. Yeah, we were like, well, thank you. We're so glad, you contacted Vic, and we got things squared away. Because, you know, I mean, that was what happened. And so, of course, we made whatever we needed to make adjustments so that he could be there. But just kind of seeing him walk with Jeffrey, and then he knew Van, and, you know, he met Van's son. I mean, just thinking of all the intergenerational things and ways that, you know, he kind of really helped facilitate, you know.
See, I'd like
and
to
he
see...
he may not be here for year 50.
I'd like to see an alumni... constituency as part of the planning of the conferences.
Yeah, you know,
each
like
year.
So
if we could figure out alumni, we can enlist in doing that. And I'll be happy to be one of them because I'll be an alumnus.
Yeah.
Only.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be an emeritus probably. But I think that, like, there's a Jim Morrell, whom I met for the first time actually in person this conference. You know the survival committee that Bill Jenkins and Jim Morrell ran during the 70s? So the Minority Student Caucus, there were more African-Americans in the school, and a lot of them were having trouble with BIOS and EPI. So Bill Jenkins and Jim Morrell, and Bill talks about this in his interview with me, formed a survival committee to help black students and then other students get through BIOS and EPI, and they were very successful. Jim Morrell was the person who did it with Bill Jenkins.
Yeah.
Jim Morrell lives in Carrboro.
Oh.
He was the first African-American scientist at RTI.
Yeah, you know, like, I think that that's what year 40 should be. I mean, that's enough time to forget, you know.
The challenge will be remember, you know, that those of us who are alumni to remember. And in fact, it's interesting. I thought the caucus was founded at a meeting in John Hatch's living room in December 1971.
It was.
Well, that's what I've heard, and that's what John Hatch told me. But I was actually reading this interview that Bill Small did. And it seemed to me that he said he came before then, and he was recruited by the caucus. So we need to, I mean, it may just be he was misremembering when he gave this interview.
But or the caucus could have not been, you know,
well, it would be nice official. To try to nail down some of these. Well, I mean, there's enough official things there. I mean, the caucus was formed.
I just feel like a lot of official things happened in like 76, 77.
Yeah, this is before then.
No, exactly.
This is before then.
And but we never even had, I don't even think I know of the date, like of the year that people met in John Hatch's living room.
Well, I don't know about the date.
I think we usually say the early 70s or in the 70s.
What John Hatch told me, it was in fall of 71.
He said 71.
I'm almost positive. Now, maybe I prompted him because that's the number I'd heard. But which would be possible to check some of that out. You know, like getting people's CVs and things like that would help. And it would be nice to have a roster of all the past caucus officers. We don't have it. I have a fair number of them, but I don't have them all. And maybe this alumni constituency, alumni part of the conference, that could be one of the things that would come out of it. Yeah. Hmm. Marva Price is someone who was here in 72. And she's around. I'm going to try to interview her. But she said not till May. So, and, you know, we've got these interviews now. I've got an interview with John Hatch, but it's not public yet because I need some editing. But, so, you know, I think the time is right, and what we need is to figure out a way to get people who can do it or get money to pay people.
Yeah.
And foundation money or whatever, maybe. It probably takes more than you can get from the... There was a student in the history department whom we talked to about writing up a history of the Minority Student Caucus and things, and he thought it would take $50,000. And this was back 20 years ago, probably. So, you know, it could be potentially a fair amount of money. But it's priceless, and I think it's a national model. You know, this is part of the long civil rights movement. This was a really powerful activity.
Yeah.
So if we have any really wealthy alumni, or if we could do fundraising. I mean, I don't know how much people would be willing to give, but, you know, if we get 50 people to give $1,000 each, it's not out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, and if somebody could get a PhD or something like that, working on something like this, that would help.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely would. I think so much of what we do in the general sense of public health is we often think ahistorically.
Exactly.
We know that we know the impact of context, and a lot of this context is often embedded through history. So.
Exactly. Exactly. History is really important because, you know, a lot of the things that we work on, we've worked on.
Yeah.
And if we could start from...
Do you want to keep these?
I don't know what this is.
This is what he gave us in the beginning.
Oh.
It was just some history stuff.
Oh, sure, yeah. Thank you.
If we could find a way to take on from where we left off... Yeah, see, Bill Small says, I came in November... That was November 71.
Bill Small came in November.
He said, Bill Small, he said, and I think he may have been mistaken because if the caucus was formed in 71, he couldn't have been hired. And he talks earlier about he was hired and it was the black students who chose him.
Yeah. You
know, he interviewed with them, and that fits with what I've heard. That they went to the dean and the dean said, okay, we can recruit somebody. He formed a committee, we can recruit somebody.
Yeah.
You help select the person. So it all seems to fit. Maybe he should have said 72 here. But anyway. So we're going to stop the tape here.